I, John, who also am your brother and companion in tribulation and in the kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ, was in the isle that is called Patmos for the word of God and for the testimony of Jesus Christ. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day and heard behind me a great voice as of a trumpet saying, What thou seest, write in a book and send it unto the seven churches which are in Asia. I am he that liveth and was dead. Behold, I am alive forevermore. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. And there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying. Neither shall there be any more pain. For the former things are passed away.
Well, good morning. I don't have time for an introduction this morning, so grab a Bible and open it to Revelation chapter 12. We are looking at the apocalypse, okay? So while you're turning there, for those of you who are visiting, or maybe you weren't here last week, want to try to bring you up to speed on where we are, okay? We're in chapter 12. And what we've noticed on the timeline of how the Bible lays out the future, we are living right now in the church age, okay? This is the time when God is reaching out primarily to the Gentiles globally. The next thing that's future to us is the rapture of the church being taken out, and then begins a seven-year period called the tribulation. The tribulation is the time when the judgments come on the earth, when the Antichrist arises, when just kind of all kinds of wild things take place. Big evangelism takes place during this time until the end when Jesus returns to establish his kingdom. So in the tribulation period, we've seen the seven seal judgments, the seven trumpet judgments, and last week when the seventh angel blew his trumpet, the announcement was made that Jesus Christ has now taken possession of the earth, which puts us right here. What we looked at last week was this period of time, this 3.5 years, that takes place when the Antichrist, who forms a covenant with the nation of Israel, brokers peace on the planet, breaks that at the 3.5 year point, and the nation of Israel now comes under persecution by the rest of the world, and this is the intense period that follows. So we talked about that in chapter 11 last week, and we got to here, but chapters 12 through 19 are going to come back and fill in the details of what takes place during this period of time. So we got to here, but we're going back in chapter 12, and we're going to dive in and take a look at that. So that's where we are today. So some of you have been kind of thinking, okay, God's working in heaven. We've seen that taking place in the book. What's the devil doing during this period of time? Okay, so what's the devil going to be doing during the tribulation period? That brings us to chapter 12. So let's dive in. Chapter 12, verse 1, a great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his head. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter, and her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. So there are three different images or people here. We've got a red dragon, right? We've got a pregnant woman, and then we've got a child who becomes a ruler. And you might say, well, like, this is weird. Who are these people, and what is this all about? Well, let me just point out a couple things to you. In the first verse, a great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. What John is saying is this is figurative language. These are symbolic. In other words, we're not actually talking about a physical red dragon. We're not actually talking about a physical woman that has the sun and the stars all around her. We're not talking about those things. We're talking about these are symbols or signs of something else that's taking place. So you have to ask the question, well, then who would these people be if they're not like a dragon and a pregnant woman and so forth? Well, that's what we're going to spend a few minutes looking at today. So let's start with the red dragon, the great dragon, because that's the easiest one to understand who it is. In verse 9, the text tells us, the great dragon that was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. So the red dragon is actually Satan himself, the devil, the evil one. That's who that is. Now, he's pictured as a dragon, and we can infer some things from that. One, a dragon is a large mythological creature that wreaks havoc on people, right? Destroys, destruction, breathes fire, kills everybody. So we know that Satan is destructive. The fact that he's enormous or great in size means he's very powerful. And red refers to rage, fury, bloodshed, violence. That's a characteristic of the devil or Satan himself. We also notice that he's got seven heads, crowns on his heads, and got a tail that sweeps the stars out of the sky. So, you know, you actually have seen pictures of Satan, you know, modern renditions with the horns and the pitchfork and the red suit and the tail. Where does that come from? It comes from this passage. Only in this passage he has seven heads, but it's hard to wear seven heads on a Halloween costume. So we kind of reduced him down to one head, you know. So that's where this comes from. Next week, we're going to talk about the heads and the horns and the crowns and what all that means in the coming weeks. Maybe not all of it next week, but hold off on that. I want us to focus on the tail. It says in verse 4, his tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. What is that referring to? Again, it's symbolic, so it's not talking about literal stars. So what could this mean? Now, I can't tell you exactly for sure, but here's a possibility. In the Old Testament, sometimes the angels are referred to as stars. Could this be that when Satan, who was a created angel himself, rebelled against God, that he also got a third of the angelic beings to join him in that rebellion? That would be the image, swept him out of the sky, pulled him to earth. And that demons are actually angelic beings created by God for good who've rebelled and joined with Satan. Now, we're going to see this group of angels or demons as what they become a little bit later on in the passage. So I think that's actually what's going on. If you want a little bit more biblical insight into Satan and his fall, Ezekiel chapter 28 has a long explanation about the king of Tyre, but as you begin to read it, you realize there's something more sinister behind that, and theologians believe that that's a discussion of the fall of Satan. So that's Ezekiel chapter 28. So that's the first one. We note the great red dragon is Satan himself. Let's go to the next easiest one to get, and that is the ruler child. The ruler child. Notice that he's standing in front of the woman because he wants to devour the child as soon as she gives birth. In verse 5, she gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter, and her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. Now, who is that? Well, in Psalm 2:9, it says that the Messiah will rule the nations with an iron scepter. So we've got a clear reference to who this is. This is none other than Jesus Christ. None other than Jesus Christ. And being snatched up to heaven to the throne room of God, it appears that that's the resurrection of Jesus Christ and his ascension up to heaven. Which leads us to the last person, who's the pregnant woman. Now, this one's a little bit more complicated. In verse 1, it says, a great wonder sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. And she's pregnant with a child. Now, who could this be? Now, when you see that image of the sun, the moon, and the 12 stars, what does it immediately remind you of? Some of you are thinking, nothing. Nothing whatsoever. So let me kind of work your memory here a little bit. Going all the way back to Genesis chapter 37, you remember the story of Joseph and his coat of many colors? And remember, Joseph has a dream, and his dream is that the sun and the moon and 11 stars bow down and worship him. And he tells that to his family, and his father, Jacob, says, are you trying to say, son, that at some point in the future, me, the sun, your mom, the moon, and 11 of your brothers, your 11 brothers, that we're going to give homage to you? In other words, he interpreted the sun, moon, and the 11 stars as referring to his own family. Who is Jacob, Joseph's father? He's the one that God gave him the name Israel. And now we see the sun, Israel, the moon, that would have been Rachel, and not 11, but 12 stars include Joseph in that. That would be the 12 tribes of Israel. I believe that this is referring to the nation of Israel. Now, some of you would say, well, isn't it referring to Mary? Because Mary gave birth to Jesus. Remember, this is a sign, it's a symbol. And the nation of Israel gave birth to the Messiah. God promised that through the line of Abraham, there would be a king that would sit on the throne ruling over the world. And so this is the nation of Israel. So in the future, in the book of Revelation, talking about the tribulation period, the nation of Israel is going to play a prominent role. Now here's something that you need to think about. From 70 AD to 1948, there was no nation of Israel. The Jewish people were scattered across the planet. It seems like it would have been impossible for this to actually be fulfilled until it happened in our time, which could give some indication that maybe we are living toward the end of God's plan for this world. It could give that indication. So now we've got the personages. We've got the great dragon, Satan himself. We've got the child, and we've got it's Jesus Christ, and we've got the nation of Israel. So immediately Satan goes on the attack, and there are three attacks that take place that Satan does in the passage. The first is his attack on Jesus, or his attack on Christ. So the first attack takes place in the birth of Jesus. Notice in verse 5, she's giving birth to a son, a male child, but Satan, the dragon, is right in front of her. As soon as she gives birth, it's wanting to devour the child. Now, did we see Satan attack Jesus in his earthly life? The answer to that question would be absolutely. If you'll recall, when the Magi saw the star in the east in the Christmas story, they come to Herod, the king in Jerusalem, and they say, "Where is the king of the Jews?" And Herod says, "Go look for him, and when you find him, let me know. I'm going to come worship him." Well, he wasn't planning to worship him. And so when Mary and Joseph find out what his plot is to kill the baby, they flee to Egypt, and he wipes out all the children that were born in Bethlehem, 2 years old and under, an attempt by Satan to kill Jesus right at his birth. Later on, we see in Jesus' earthly ministry, when he first starts, Satan comes to him, and we have the temptation of Jesus, where three times Satan tries to get Jesus to go off course and to give in to Satan, and so Satan again is attacking Jesus. The final attack on Jesus is the attack that takes place at the cross. Judas is a henchman of Satan. The religious leaders join in that. The Romans join in that. And for a moment, as Jesus is being crucified, the great dragon, Satan, feels like he's winning. Jesus is dying. But Jesus snatches victory out of the jaws of defeat when he rises from the dead, securing salvation through his death and his suffering, giving eternal life to his people. And notice what it says here in verse 5. It says, her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. In other words, when Jesus ascends to heaven, he now goes to the throne room of God and opens up the throne room, the access for people to come to faith and be brought right into a relationship with God. And so Satan's attack fails. Well, the second attack that takes place is an attack on heaven, and actually Satan is on the defensive in this one. Notice verse 7. It says, there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. Now, these two sentences have raised a whole lot of speculation about what's taking place, and I'll tell you what we know. There's not very much information here. We know who Michael is. Michael is one of the archangels that guards the holiness of God. He grabbed all of the angels that are God's angels, and he went after Satan, and there was a battle in heaven. Satan brought all of the demons together, and there was a war that took place. Now, what would that war have looked like? I don't know. Did they use lightsabers? I don't know. You know, we get George Lucas in here. He could probably illustrate what all happened here. We really have very limited information, but the result of that is that Satan is defeated and he's cast out of heaven. In other words, Satan now has no access to God, no interaction with God. He's now cast to earth, which means that evil is now going to be incarnate on the planet during these last 3.5 years of the tribulation period. And that's really about all we know about this battle. There's really not a whole lot of more information that we can glean from this. That losing their place in heaven, actually the Greek is permanent, like it's they've lost forever their place in heaven. There's no place for Satan to ever try to ascend back into the presence of God. It's gone. And then in verse 9, we have a description so that John lays out for us so that nobody will get confused as to who we're dealing with here. Look at what it says. That great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. Okay, so fivefold description. In case you haven't given much thought to who the devil is, let me reintroduce you to who the devil is. So here's what John says. Five titles. The first one is that great dragon. Now, we talked about what the dragon is. It's a mythological creature that destroys. So Satan is the destroyer. His goal is to ruin God's creation, to ruin humanity, to ruin what God has made that's beautiful and good and lovely and wise and holy. His goal is to destroy all that. The second title that's given to him in this passage is the ancient serpent. Now, we recall when this took place because the serpent, or Satan, was in the Garden of Eden and tempted Eve and Adam, and they ate of the tree, and that plunged the world into sin. If you recall, Satan has two lies that he uses effectively all the time, and every one of us in here have heard him say them in our mind at one time or another. The first lie that he says is that God is not telling the truth. God's not telling the truth. When he said, if you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will die. He's lying about that. You will not surely die. And daily, when the Spirit of God prompts you to lean into goodness and to lean away from those things that are selfish and evil, Satan is saying, oh no, indulge yourself. It'll feel good. It'll make you happy. It'll make you look good. It'll make your life better. Go ahead and do it. There will be no consequences. That's the first lie. The second lie that Satan tells us all the time is that God is not really good. God's not really good. Remember what he said to Eve? He said, God's not wanting you to eat of the tree because he knows that the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open, you'll know good and evil, you'll be like him. In other words, God is trying to keep you from doing the things that will really satisfy you, make you happy, enjoy it. He's not that good. And every day, Satan is telling us these really interesting things like, well, if God really loved you, you would have gotten that job. The fact that you didn't get that job, that means God doesn't really love you. He's not that good. If God really loved you, you would have had that experience. People would have treated you differently. This wouldn't have gone down the way it would. Your health would be perfect. If God really loved you, life would go well for you. So if it goes poorly at times, God doesn't really love you. Those lies come out all the time. Jesus said this about Satan. When he talks, he lies because that's his native language. Everything that comes out of his mouth is not true. And so that's him in the world as the ancient serpent speaking lies to us. Here's the third description. The Greek word devil means accuser or defamer, the one who slanders us while he's tempting us. We'll come back to this in a minute. And then the word Satan is actually the Hebrew word, which means the same thing, the accuser. And John wants to make sure that we get all of these words. Like, he's the accuser in Greek, and he's the accuser in Hebrew. He's the accuser in every language. And then he wraps it up with this one. He's the one who leads the whole world astray. He's the one who leads the whole world astray. Now, I want us to think about that for a minute. What is the universal beliefs that people hold on to that defy reality and logic? They're just not true. That's what Satan's doing. And I got to tell you, folks, it's phenomenal the things that people in our world believe that defy logic and history and reality, and yet we hold them as something that is, this has got to be right. This has got to be true. Personally, I finished book 5 of the 6-volume abridged set of Winston Churchill's autobiography. So Churchill's describing what happened before World War II, what happened during, and what happened after from his perspective. And I've been reading through this. Here's what's so bizarre to me. So the attitude of the people that were leading the League of Nations in Europe right before World War II, while Hitler was building his arms, after he had clearly communicated that his goal was to take over Europe and extinguish the Jewish people, and then move on to religious people from there. Like, that was all written, published, everybody knew it. And yet what you hear coming out of the mouths of the leaders about peace and harmony, and if we just respond to evil with love, it'll all get better. And I'm thinking to myself, that wasn't that long ago. How did that work out for the world? 25 million people dying in World War II. How did that work out? But you know what? As I listen to our global leaders, I hear the exact same words coming out of their mouth. The exact same words. Now, I'm not talking about a biblical idea here. I'm just talking about wake up and read your history. And why is it? So here's what I come to the conclusion. There's got to be a devil. Because why could so many intelligent people think so stupidly about the world and about ideas and about truth? How could we forget? How could we forget this stuff? But we do. Humanity's basically good, so therefore anybody who does something evil must be insane. Hear that all the time. Oh, that guy in Orlando, he was insane. He was talking on his cell phone, texting his wife, posting stuff on Facebook. He made sure that before he went in that he picked a soft target. He took in the right amount of ammo to be able to do what he planned to do, had a strategy for talking it through, and made sure that his assets were transferred to his family because he knew he was going to be killed. Does that sound like somebody who is insane? But we come up with this kind of crazy stuff. And after the Orlando massacre, there was more negative talk in our country about Christianity than there was about radical Islam. How can that be? Like, that's just insane, isn't it? It's just absolutely insane. 1.6 billion people on the planet embrace a religion that in its books, the Quran and the Hadiths, teach that if you leave that religion, that capital punishment is the right thing to happen to you, and more than 50% of its adherents worldwide actually believe that that's true. And somehow, that's peaceful and loving. I just don't get it. How could that be? In fact, the fact that I just said what I just said, which is actually documentably true, is hate speech. How can that be? You know how that can be? Because there's somebody that works in the global collective thoughts of the world to keep bringing up these crazy failed ways of thinking. And it comes from the highest levels of academia, of industry now, of government, of entertainment industry, the arts. It comes from the highest levels of this. And so many of us believe it. Good, nice, loving, caring people that are super intelligent. There's got to be a devil. How could they be so? How could we be so? That's why as Christians, we need to be careful that we put our effort and energy into listening to what God says and then looking at what actually is going on in the world. What actually happened in the world. Because that way we can see what's actually true, okay? Because Satan's on a mission. Okay, let's keep going here. That's my rant. Done with it for a minute. Okay, so verse 10, watch what happens. He gets hurled down, heard a loud voice in heaven, said, "Now have come the salvation and power and kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ." In other words, again, they're restating that Jesus is taking charge of the world, for the accuser of our brothers who accuses them before our God day and night has been hurled down. The accuser, that's the word devil, the word Satan, the accuser of our brothers. Here's the crazy thing that oftentimes we don't get. See, we think that all's fair. Okay, so if Satan tempts you and you fall in line with his direction, he's going to put his arm around you and say, "Hey, thanks for coming over to my side. Welcome to the family. I'm going to take care of you and give you good things." That's not what he does. He tempts you, and when he tempts you, he immediately points out to God, "Look at one of yours is sinning. Isn't the penalty for sin death? You have to judge them and send them to hell." In other words, as the destroyer, he not only wants to get us to sin, but then he goes back and accuses us before God. And heaven is rejoicing in this passage because Satan has no access to go accuse us anymore. Jesus Christ has taken control and there's no access. I came across an artistic way of talking about this accusing. Let me just read it to you. Starts with, "I sinned, and straightway post haste Satan flew before the presence of the most holy God and made a railing accusation there. He said, 'This soul, this thing of clay and sod has sinned. 'Tis true that he has named thy name, but I demand his death, for thou hast said, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. Shall not thy sentence be fulfilled? Is justice dead? Send now this wretched sinner to his doom. What other thing can righteous ruler do?' And thus he did accuse me day and night, and every word he spoke, O God, was true. Then quickly one rose up from God's right hand, before whose glory angels veiled their eyes. He spoke, 'Each jot and tittle of the law must be fulfilled. The guilty sinner dies.' But wait, suppose his guilt were transferred to me and that I paid his penalty. Behold, my hands, my feet, my side. One day I was made sin for him and died, that he might be presented faultless at thy throne." And Satan flew away. Full well he knew that he would not prevail against such love, for every word my Lord spoke was true. Jesus defeats Satan by taking our sin upon himself, but Satan's goal is to tempt you and then accuse you. While he's telling you, "Go play, it will be so fun," he's laughing because he knows when you do, it's going to ruin your life. It's going to damage our world, and he's going to go to a holy God and say, "God, if you're really just, you have to deal with that person." That's the nature of who we're dealing with here in Satan. So how do we defeat him? Look at verse 11. He says, "They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimonies. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death." So three things that were at their power and are at our power to overcome him. The first one is this. They overcome him by the blood of the Lamb. The fact that Jesus Christ has died and paid for our sins means that we have an advocate who atones for our sins. We are not under the judgment. And so we defeat him because of what Jesus did on our behalf. Second, by the word of our testimony. What is the word of our testimony? That's the gospel message. Do you realize that every single person that puts their trust in Jesus and becomes clean before him, that that person is now brought out of the bondage of Satan's prison camp and put into the freedom of God, the freedom of God's love. And so by us as the church sharing the good news and watching our friends and neighbors and people come to faith in Jesus, when we do that, that's how we overcome Satan. If you want to turn America back to its values, the best thing you can do is not going to happen in the voting booth. It's going to happen in the conversations that you have, sharing with people the love of Jesus. That's what changes the world. The love of Jesus is what changes the world. And so that's how they defeated Satan. And then third, he says, they didn't love their lives even to the point of death. They didn't love their lives even to the point of death. Now, if you get to a point in your life where you don't love your life even to the fact death, who's got leverage on you? So pay attention to what you love. If you love things that are earthbound and not heavenbound, Satan can use that as leverage. So if your success is something that you love, Satan can mess with your success. And oftentimes, that's the place of distraction or compromise, or your beauty, or your fun. If you fall in love with the wrong kinds of things and follow those, Satan can use those in your life as leverage to distract you and to get you off track. So Satan's now hurled down to earth, and watch what it says in verse 12. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them, but woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He's filled with fury because he knows that his time is short. So Satan is now cast down to earth. This is the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period, and it's going to get intensely ugly on the planet. Watch what happens in the final battle when he goes after Israel. In verse 13, when the dragon saw that he had been hurled to earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman was given 2 wings of an eagle so that she might fly to a place prepared for her in the desert where she would be taken care of for a time, times, and half a time out of the serpent's reach. Well, now, what does this look like and how does this happen? I'm not sure exactly what this looks like, but he's coming after her and she escapes into the desert. I don't know if the wings are the wings of a 747. I don't know if there's a bunker in the desert someplace, but the nation of Israel fleeing from Jerusalem and they're going someplace to hide out, and Satan is coming after her. He opens his mouth and out of it spews water like a river in verse 5, but the earth opens up, verse 15, verse 16, the earth opens up, swallows up that. I don't know if that's an army, I don't know if that's a demon, I don't know what that is, we don't know. And then the dragon was outraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. That's probably talking about the 144,000. We're going to see them again in chapter 14. And the dragon stood on the shore of the sea. Now, chapter 13, the dragon is going to call up, Satan's going to call up out of the sea his two henchmen, the Antichrist and the false prophet. So next week, we're going to look at the mark of the beast. We're going to look at the Antichrist. All some really interesting stuff. So you got to come back next week if you want to find out more about it. Anyway, the nation of Israel is under severe persecution. Satan's going after them. And then we see another time marker. It's time, times, and half a time. What does that mean? Well, we've seen 3 time markers already, and I believe they refer to the last half of the tribulation period. The first one we saw was 42 months. That's 3.5 years. Then in this passage again, we see 1,260 days. That's 3.5 years. And then we see this one, time, times, and half a time. I think it's talking about the same period. Time, 1 year, times, more than 1 year, right? 2 years. Half a time would be half of the equivalent of this. Again, I think that's 3.5 years. So these things are taking place during this intense period, during the tribulation period, and we'll find out more about the Antichrist as we come back next week. Now, let me wrap up with some very straightforward application for us. When it comes to our lives and Satan himself, first of all, if you're not growing closer to Jesus, you are vulnerable to Satan. Some of you are saying, where's that in the Bible? Thank you for asking. Look at what Peter says. He says, be self-controlled and alert. Self-controlled means that you have your passions under control. You have your desires under control. They're not controlling you. You control them. And alert, you're awake to what's taking place around you spiritually. And then he says, your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith. You guys have seen the National Geographic pictures of how the lions hunt the gazelles, right? They chase the herd and they pick off the ones at the back, the ones that are weak, the ones that are old, the ones that are not fit, and those are the ones that become lion food. Christian people who are not spending time with God in prayer and in the Word, who don't have any accountability relationships, who are not trying to walk in holiness and righteousness, using their gifts in service of the kingdom, Christians that are not doing those things, though you think, well, let me just take a time out from that because I've got a lot going on in my life and I'll pick it back up later, you are more vulnerable to Satan's lies and attacks in your life. Growing is the only way to really truly be able to overcome the work of Satan. Here's my second thought. It doesn't have to be ugly to damage you. It doesn't have to be ugly to damage you. Most of the time we think, well, like doing something wrong is like killing somebody or at least hurting their feelings. Like that's the ugly stuff. But it doesn't have to be ugly to damage you. I want you to see another passage of Scripture. 2 Corinthians 11, 13, and 14. Paul's talking about false prophets. He says, for such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. Now, if Satan came to you and showed you the fallout and the ugliness for wrong decisions, you would say, well, I'm not going to do that because it's going to ruin me. So Satan doesn't present things to you in those packages. He presents things to you as pleasurable. And so that person in the office that gets you when your spouse doesn't, and that feels so good, how could that not be true love? That's what Satan, that's how he works. That's what he does. And so just because it doesn't look ugly doesn't mean it's not going to kill you, going to hurt you, going to take you under. So you have to be aware of that and be obedient to God. Here's my third one, my final one. Don't give yourself to things that Jesus came to destroy. Don't give yourself to things that Jesus came to destroy. Watch this. 1 John chapter 3, verse 8, he who does what is sinful is of the devil because the devil has been sinning from the beginning. That's what he does, okay? That's his behavior. The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. Jesus ultimately will put sin and death under his feet. They will reign no more. They will be eradicated. The only way for the beauty of God's creation, for justice and mercy and righteousness and peace and love to reign in the human family is when those things that work against that pride, selfishness, bigotry, all the injustices, evil, until those things are eliminated. So for the person who's following Jesus to engage or indulge in the things that Jesus came to destroy seems counterproductive to the kingdom. What we're all longing for is the kingdom of Jesus. And in the meantime, to do the behaviors that destroy the kingdom is to actually work against your very soul. So my challenge to us today is, folks, this is not a net neutral world. There are forces that are sinister in nature that want to undermine your life. But be of good cheer. Jesus has overcome Satan. He's going to be cast down. He's going to ultimately be destroyed. And in the meantime, we can overcome him by walking closely with Jesus. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, I do thank you for the victory that's coming. Father, in this world, we know that there are so many ways that we can be distracted and dissuaded from being loyal to you. Father, may today you reveal to us places in our heart. Are there any places that we're getting off track, that we've opened up a window or a door for Satan to step in and direct us away from that which is good? Father, today may we open our lives back to you. Father, may we have a healthy fear of evil. May it drive us to your righteousness. So, Father, would you move in us today? Open our minds, open our hearts, open our eyes to your truth and to the change and freedom that comes in you.